So the title is here, Cooling on Neutron Stars with Superfluid Cores. That was a project which lasted for 5 years and it was finished about 2 years ago. So the main participants are listed here. I would like to mention three of them. First, Oleg Nedin, he wrote our cooling codes. Second, Ksenia Levin-Fish, who ran this cooling codes. And the main, our main author, H.A., H.A. means honorable author, is Danny Pash, because this project started after the wonderful paper by Pash and Applegate in 1992. Who showed that the superfluidity in the neutron star core is a strong regulator of the cooling, and they called the situation neutron stars as thermometers of the critical temperatures of the superfluidity in their cores. And what we did, we tried to develop this idea rather unsuccessfully, as you will see.
Yes.
The talk map is like this. First, the introduction. Second, superfluidity and heat capacity in neutron star cores. Third, neutron emission mechanisms in the neutron star cores. Then theory versus observations and conclusions. Well, point one, introduction. This is a schematic picture of neutron star, very well known here. The basic unit of density in the neutron stars is the nuclear matter density rho zero, which is equal to 2.8 × 10⁻¹⁴ grams per centimeter. You can see that the neutron star can be subdivided into four layers: outer crust, inner crust, outer core, and inner core. I will not discuss the crust in this talk, and I will focus on the neutron star cores. The neutron star core extends from the density about half of the nuclear matter density to the center of the star. And the outer core is formally rather simple because it consists of neutrons mainly with some admixture of protons and electrons. And the inner core is more complicated because other particles may appear. But today I will simplify our life as much as possible, and I will neglect all these exotic particles, hyperons, pions, kaons, quarks, and so on. Let us consider the simplest model of the neutron star, with the core composed of the neutrons with the admixture of protons and electrons. The main mystery of neutron stars is the equation of state in the core. We do not know which is the equation of state. Stiff, moderate, or soft, as James Latimer discussed at the conference. So, how to investigate this problem? How to constrain the equation of state in the core? There are many ways, and one of them is to study neutron star cooling. This is schematical, well, figures. The neutron star cooling is a very simple process. The energy which is accumulated in the neutron star core is lost in the cooling process in two different ways. The star cools first by the electromagnetic radiation from the surface, and second by the emission of neutrinos from the entire stellar body. So this loss of thermal energy is produced by the neutrino emissivity and the photon emissivity of the star. And the photon emissivity is given by this very simple black body equation. And so we see that there are three main ingredients of the cooling. First, the heat capacity of the star. Second, the neutrino emissivity. These ingredients belong mainly to the neutron star cores, because the emissivity is produced mainly in the neutrino reactions in the neutron star cores, and the heat capacity mainly sits in the neutron star cores. And the third ingredient, the relationship between the internal stellar temperature and the surface temperature, this relationship is determined by the thermal conductivity in the various surface layers of the neutron stars, and I will not discuss this relationship today. Let us assume that it is given. So the main output of the cooling theory is the so-called cooling curve, which is the dependence of the surface temperature on time. This cooling curve depends on neutron star models. So that is why there is potential possibility to compare the cooling curves calculated for different models with observations and find out which cooling curve is better fitted, so which neutron star model is better than the other ones. Yes. And it is very important that neutrons and protons in the neutron star cores may be superfluid. This superfluidity is nuclear one. It is produced by attractive part of the nuclear-nucleon interaction. The critical temperature of the superfluidity can be calculated from microscopic theories, but these calculations are extremely uncertain. This figure shows this uncertainty. Logarithm of mass density, this is vertical scale, is logarithm of critical temperatures of the superfluidities of neutrons, solid lines, and protons, dashed lines, for different microscopic models. You see that we can have anything what we need, or what we wish. That is why there is potential possibility again to study these critical temperatures by astrophysical methods. Let us calculate different models and compare with observations, with hope that we will understand anything, but we will not, of course.
Are all these models based just on different two-body nucleon-nucleon interactions?
Yes.
All the simple potential models of different fits to nuclear data?
Yes, there are different nuclear-nucleon interactions and different versions of the many-body theory.
Uh-huh.
So, I've finished the introduction, and I can come to the point two of my talk. Superfluidity. So let us focus on the superfluidity in the neutron star cores. Basically, it is thought that this is BCS superfluidity produced due to an attraction part of the nuclear-nucleon interaction. The nuclear-nucleon interaction is well known to be like this. This is the potential energy, this is the distance between nucleons, and there is an attractive part, a long-range attractive part, and a short-range repulsive core. Due to the attractive part, the nucleons may form Kuiper pairs. The types of the neutron and proton superfluidities in the neutron star cores are different. The proton superfluidity is of the simplest type. It's a singlet state pairing. And the neutron superfluidity cannot be produced in the singlet state of the Cooper neutron pairs, but it is produced in the triplet state. Microscopically, the superfluidity manifests itself in appearance of the gap in the nucleon dispersion relation. As drawn here, this is the energy versus momentum. If there is no superfluidity, we have the simplest dispersion relation. quadratic, for instance, and in the presence of superfluidity, we have a gap near the Fermi level. If the pairing is singlet state, I'll call this case case 1, the gap is independent on the angle between the momentum of the neutron and of the nucleon and the quantization axis. But in the case of the triplet state pairing, the situation is more complicated, and this gap depends on the position of the wave vector on the Fermi surface. I won't discuss this this situation is rather complicated. I won't discuss it in the details, but I will consider the simplest triplet state case, case B, I'll call it, which corresponds to the total momentum of the pairing neutrons equal to zero, and in this case the gap depends on the angle theta between the proton momentum and the quantization axis in this manner. This is, well, as shown here. The gap is maximum at the poles of the thermosphere and is minimum at the equator. The gap depends on temperature, like this. If temperature is higher than the critical temperature of the appearance of the superfluidity, then there is no gap at all, there is no phase transition. But when temperature becomes lower, then the gap appears. First it is small, but when temperature decreases to zero, the gap decreases to some constant density, zero temperature gap. This zero temperature gap is directly related to the critical temperature, that is why it is all the same to define this zero temperature gap or to define the critical temperatures. And according to the numerals calculations, microscopic calculation, the critical temperatures of neutrons and protons in the neutron star core vary from 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 7 kelvins to 10 to the 10 kelvins. They are very model-dependent quantities.
Well, you might have answered this, but in comparing case B and case C, M equals 0 and M equals 2, will that make a very great difference in the phenomenology because of the vanishing of the gap at theta equals 0?
Certainly, but the bulk, majority of the microscopic calculations ignore case C completely.
Right.
In several calculations, case C is included, and in many cases it appears that case B is preferable than case C with respect to the free energy, to the main indicator which case is realized in nature is free energy. Let us calculate the free energy of the system and see which free energy is smaller. Yes, but actually the problem is open, and the problem is even more complicated because in some calculations the mixed state of cases M0 and M2 and M1 is more preferable than the case B or case C. And in this mixed state there is no note of the gap. But nevertheless, this is a complicated subject which is not entirely explored microscopically. Well, so I'll start with heat capacity of the neutron star cores. Let us assume, for instance, that there is no superfluidity. We have three different particle species, so that the heat capacity consists of either sum of heat capacities of neutrons, protons, and electrons. The dominant contribution comes from the neutrons. The protons give about 25% into the heat capacity, and the electrons give about 5%. The total heat content in the neutron star core is about 10^4, 48 ergs if the internal temperature is 10^9 kelvins. And the heat, the thermal energy scales as T squared. The heat capacity of free particles is very simple, given in the textbooks. So there is no problem here. If we switch on the superfluidity of neutrons and protons, the situation becomes more complicated, because the superfluidity, the heat capacities of neutrons and protons will become affected by the superfluidity. And the situation is like this. Here is the partial heat capacity versus temperature. If temperature is higher than the critical temperature, the heat capacity decreases happily with temperature as T. But when there is a phase transition, there is a jump of superfluidity. The jump is about a factor of 2. And then rapid decrease, exponential decrease, because of the presence of the energy gap.
At what point do electrons give appreciable heat capacity, or is it never?
I'll show you the figure. So this, this is like this. Now the relevant figure is here. Here is the ratio of the proper heat capacity to the heat capacity of non-superfluid nucleon versus temperature. This is case A, this is case B, and these dashed lines are warning not to use very simplified calculations, because in many calculations, this ratio is approximated by a simple Boltzmann-like factor, like exp minus delta zero divided by T. And here, these simplified ratios are shown. They are shown according to Maxwell. Maxwell, in 1979, was the first who introduced them. And the warning is, please be careful, because sometimes it is better to use the results of exact calculations than the simplified one. For instance, let us assume that the temperature is 10 times smaller than the critical temperature of the superfluidity, and let us compare this exact ratio for case A and approximate ratio for case A. The difference is 4 orders of magnitude. Now, how it looks like in the real case. Let us assume that the density is twice the nuclear matter density. And this figure showed the dependence of the heat capacity on temperature. The critical temperatures of the neutron superfluidity is here, and the critical temperature of the proton superfluidity is here. If temperature is higher than all the critical temperatures, the neutron contribution dominates, but then we have two jumps associated with the appearance of neutron and proton superfluids. But when the the temperature is much smaller than the critical temperature of all the superfluidity, so then the electron contribution is dominant. So I finished point two of my talk, and I'm coming to point three, neutrino emission from neutron star cores. Here are the main neutrino emission mechanisms. In very simplified model of neutron star matter, if the model were more complicated, for instance, if we added muons and simplest hyperon, sigma minus hyperon and lambda hyperon, there would be about 50 different mechanisms which could be important. But here there are not many. The most important mechanism is Dirac Turco process. If it is switched on in the neutron star matter, then the neutron emissivity is huge, as written here, about 10 to the 27 ergs per centimeter cubic per second for the temperature of 10 to the 9 kelvins. And the neutrino emissivity of the neutron star is also very huge. But the trouble with this mechanism is that it can be switched off, is switched on only in high density matter, when the number density of protons exceeds the number density of, is higher than 1/8 of the number density of the neutrons. So this happens for some selected equation of state, not for all of them. And this happens in high density matter. This means rather massive neutron stars. If it is switched off, but then the main neutrino production mechanism, yes, Dirac Turco is beta decay of the neutron, that's very simple, and capture of the electron by proton with production of neutrino pairs. Very simple mechanism, and that is why it is very intensive. If this mechanism is switched off, then the modified Urco process is the main neutrino production mechanism. It is more complicated. It is basically the same, but in the presence of additional nucleon. It may be either neutron or proton. So there are two branches of the modified Urco process, the neutron branch and then proton branch of comparable intensity. But this mechanism is naturally much less efficient. Typically, the emissivity in the modified Urco process is 5 or 6 orders of magnitude lower, like this. In addition, there are also nucleon-nucleon Bremsstrahlung processes. This means production of neutrino pairs in nucleon-nucleon collisions. Very simple reaction as well. There are three reactions, naturally, in our case. Neutron-neutron collisions, neutron-proton collisions, and proton-proton collisions. They give the neutrino emissivity a factor of 2 lower than the modified Urco process. And here I presented also...
A factor of 20.
It depends.
Well, from what is written here, at least.
20, this means a factor of, well, 1 or 2, yes, sorry, factor of, by 10 or maybe 100, low, by factor of 100 low. I'll show the figure. Yes, and this is one more exotic neutrino production process. It is very miserable. It is production of neutrino pairs in electron-electron collisions. This is purely electromagnetic process. That is why it is very slow. It gives the emissivity is about 4 orders of magnitude lower than in the Bremsstrahlung process. Well, I think that I can spend several minutes to explain this funny word, urka, because we must know the origin of this word, and I'm sure that nobody here knows this origin. Absolutely, except Head Judge Pavlov, if he could.
Well, we can find his book, so be careful.
Yes, the official story is like this. It is a joke of Judge Gamov. And Gamov met his co-author Schoenberg, who introduced into the physics Urca processes, but not with nucleons, but atomic nuclei. He met him in Casino de Urca in Rio de Janeiro, and he described this meeting in his book, biographical book, My World Line, like this. We called it the Urca process, partially to commemorate the casino in which we met, and partially because the Urca process results in a rapid disappearance of thermal energy from the interior of the star, similar to the rapid disappearance of money from the pockets of gamblers on the Casino de Urca. So this is the story. And I would like to mention, from my point of view, this is not one joke of Judge Gamov, but this is the double joke. Because certainly Judge Gamov was born in Russia, and he couldn't be unaware of the fact that there is a word Urka in Russian language. This is criminal slang. I consulted special book, and it means thief. Particularly very skillful pocket thief who will take money from your pocket until you say Judge Gamov. So I'm absolutely sure that this is the double joke of Judge Gamov. Moreover, my colleague Xenia Levinfish, who ran this court, she did the next step. She abbreviated direct Urca process as Durka and modified Urca process as Murka. Both words are Russian words. Durka comes from Russian word Dura, which means absolutely foolish woman. Murka comes from Russian, this is nickname from Russian word Maria. From name Maria, and it is usually well used to mention not a lady but just the opposite, a woman of not very strict behavior, perhaps a woman which is engaged in criminal business. So we are now dealing with Russian criminal words, Russian criminal world. And finally, if Durka is open, then neutron star will cool rapidly. I will call this fast cooling or rapid cooling or Durka cooling, which the Durka cooling is more exact. If Durka is forbidden in the neutron star, then we have the case of slow cooling or standard cooling, or I'll call it Murka cooling. Murka is better, to my point of view.
Well, I think, I mean, just to put in an opinion, I think it's better anyway. Jim Latimer in his talk emphasized, you know, that a symmetry energy would give you direct Urca, and then managed to imply that there was some experimental indication for the symmetry energy. But what he didn't say was that when you're talking about twice nuclear density, there's a big density dependence they put in there, which just came out of single sigma bottles or some arbitrary container coming from the particle world that shouldn't be taken seriously.
So this is, well, this is open question.
Yeah, of course it's open, but I don't think there's any argument for their in favor of their conclusions coming directly from phenomenology, as he implied there was.
Okay.
What was the symmetry energy?
I'm not understanding. What do you mean? The growth of the signature energy with density?
When you wanted a twice nuclear density, then you have to put in a density dependence of the energy, and
yeah.
that comes from these sigma models, and so that's fine and dandy, but at least you should say it's not from the data.
Yes. Then what happens if we have superfluid neutron star core? The superfluidity acts in two ways. First, it suppresses, due to the presence of superfluid gap, all the neutrino reactions which involve nucleons, Dohrke, Moorka, and Bremsstrahlung processes. And second, it switches on entirely new neutrino production mechanism, neutrino emission due to Cooper pairing of nucleons. First, about this superfluid suppression. It can be written like this. Let the emissivity of the neutrino production be Q. Let the emissivity in non-superfluid matter be Q0. And Q can be written as Q0 multiplied by R, which can be called the suppression factor of this particular process by the neutron superfluidity. And that was the main object of our study. Calculation of this suppression factor is a tiresome job which we didn't finish because it is extremely, well, dull, I would say. And my students just refuse. But generally it looks like this. Let it be the logarithm of the emissivity versus logarithm of temperature. If there is no superfluidity, if temperature is higher than Tc, then we have, well, powerful low temperature dependence of the emissivity, which is straight line in these coordinates. And if the superfluidity is switched on, the process is suppressed. If we have only one particle superfluid, the suppression is like this, exponential, but of course it is necessary, it is better to use exact calculations, because this simple estimate strongly underestimates its, overestimates the effect of the superfluidity. And here is my second warning. For instance, consider Dohrke process, which involves neutrons and protons, and both particles can be superfluid. And in many, and the actual suppression factor is like this. Consider two gaps, neutrons and protons. Let us take the maximum one, and let us write this simple exponent using the maximum gap, and this will be the correct answer. In many papers, the answer, the formula which was used is quite different. It is natural, but it is incorrect. Because in many papers, it is often used the product of exponents of neutrons and protons. Since each exponent, neutron 1 and proton 1, is very small, this may, well, give very different answer from the reality. Now the figures. Oh, no, sorry. Cooper pairing. Yes, there is one more process which is important, Cooper pairing. It is very simple. Let us consider this dispersion relation with the gap. And simply, from my point of view, the meaning of the process is like this. If there is no gap, then we have a free nucleon which cannot emit neutrino power due to energy momentum conservation. It is very easy to show. But if there is a superfluid gap, a neutron can, nucleon can jump from this part to this jump. Energy momentum conservation rules will be satisfied, so it can emit neutrino parent this way. So actually this is transition from a nucleon from one state to another with production of the neutrino pair. But if you are a theoretician, then of course you should introduce complication in this simplified picture. You should consider not the new nucleons but quasi-nucleons, and you will be forced to consider this process as annihilation of two quasi-nucleons into neutrino pairs. But this is basically absolutely the same. Well, the trouble with this mechanism is that it was, well, first calculated by Flowers, Ruderman, and Sutherland in 1976 and absolutely forgotten. Then in 10 years it was rediscovered independently by Voskresensky and Sinatorov. I discussed this problem with Voskresensky. They really discovered this process independently. They didn't know the work of Flowers, Ruderman, and Sutherland. And then it was completely forgotten again for 10 years. And it was Danny Pash who rediscovered the process for the third time.
No, I found it from a paper of Christoph Schad, who I think Svorov and Sedrakian worked with Voskresensky.
When you visited St. Petersburg in 1994, you told me about this process, but I forgot until I saw your paper. So I'm sure that Danny knew about this process. Okay. It's a pity that Mel Ruderman is not here, otherwise he could be interrogated. And perhaps we would know the
maybe
truth.
Maybe we know about the paper in 1966, right?
There are two figures which show the dependence of the neutrino emissivity of different reactions in non-superfluid matter. This is the dependence on temperature. The leading the temperature twice rho zero, there is no Durka here, only Murka, which is the leading reaction, and then Bremsstrahlung reactions and this miserable electron-electron collision mechanism. This is the dependence of the emissivity on the density. Again, the Murka is the leading process, and electron-electron collision is the slowest one. Nothing interesting, absolutely plain as the lowest servant, I would say. Now let us switch on. Let us continue the last picture, the last figure, to higher densities. There are three temperatures here, 10 to the 9, 3 times 10 to the 8, and 10 to the 8 kelvins. And here is the total neutrino emissivity in all the neutrino production reactions. For instance, consider the temperature 10 to the 9. And the curve is like this. It is plain because Murka is operative, and then Dirac Durka, Durka is switched on, and the emissivity jumps by 5 orders of magnitude. This is the temperature dependence of the Cooper pairing for two cases, A, B, and C, for one particular density, and for neutron pairing with this critical temperature 10 to the 9. The emissivity has peak. There is no emissivity until the superfluidity appears. Then there is large peak and then exponential decay. These are two cases. The first case, low density matter Durk is forbidden. The second case is high density matter Durk is switched on. And matter is superfluid, neutron and protons are superfluid. At high temperatures, Durka is the main neutrino production mechanism, and at low temperatures, the Cooper pairing becomes dominant. Here, and at high temperature, temperatures, Murka is dominant, and at low temperatures, Cooper pairing is most important. This is my favorite figure, which shows the domains in which different neutrino production mechanisms are important. There are two densities, twice nuclear matter density, no Durka, and five nuclear matter densities, Durka. If there were no and three temperatures, 10 to the 8, 3 times 10 to the 8, and 10 to the 9. If there were no superfluidity, in this case Murka would be dominant, and in this case Durka would be dominant. But let us switch on the superfluidity of neutrons and protons, as shown here. This is logarithm of the proton critical temperature and logarithm of neutron critical temperature. And if we switch the superfluidity, then different mechanism, the superfluidity suppresses different neutrino reactions, but in different ways. And that is why numerous mechanisms, which otherwise would be absolutely unimportant, become dominant. For instance, you can consider this case. You can see that Murka is still dominant here, but Cooper pairing of protons dominant here, Cooper pairing of neutrons here, neutrino bremsstrahlung, nuclear-nuclear bremsstrahlung here, and this miserable mechanism, production of neutrinos in electron-electron collisions, becomes dominant in highly superfluid matter, in which the superfluidity switches off all the neutrino production mechanisms in the reactions involving nucleons. So I finished my third point, and now I can come to cooling, comparing theory with observations. Now we are ready to calculate the cooling on neutron stars with superfluid cores. The main problem is how to implement the density dependence of the critical temperatures. And since this density dependence is absolutely unknown, so we adopt the simplest assumption, which is initially, from the very beginning, it is wrong. And we just wanted to see what it is, what does it mean. But when we started to use, to consider this case, we could not stop. The simplest assumption is like this. Let the critical temperatures of the neutron and proton superfluids be constant over the cores, but these constants will be treated as two independent parameters. One parameter for neutron and the second for proton superfluid. Here are two sets of the cooling curves. The first set corresponds to the neutron star of the mass 1.3 solar mass. This is example of slow cooling, Murka cooling, because the direct Durka process is not switched on in such a low massive neutron star. And this is the example of more massive star, 1.48 solar mass. Here, Durka is switched on. So this is the example of Durka cooling. These red lines are non-superfluid curves. you see that in the case of Dirkov cooling, non-superfluid curve is very low, so the surface temperature of the neutron star is very low because very strong neutrino production mechanism inside the star operates. And these cases are solid and dashed black lines correspond to the cooling curves with superfluidity of neutrons and protons inside the core. And the logarithm of the critical temperatures of the neutron and proton superfluidity are written here. The dashed lines are calculated neglecting Cooper pairing. For instance, here we have these dashed lines. And if we include the Cooper pairing, this means additional neutrino production, additional cooling, we will have this solid line. So you can see that Cooper pairing is extremely important. These are observations. You can see our seven darling guys here, neutron stars Gemindo Vela 0656 1055, and the three neutron stars associated with supernova remnants 0822 1207 0002. Seven stars and 15 observational data, because these observations, the results of observations, the surface temperatures is deduced from the observations in two different ways. The open circles correspond to the atmospheric interpretation of the observations, and the black circles correspond to black body interpretation. So first of all, let us draw non-superfluid curves for these two particular values of the mass. The Murka cooling with non-superfluid curves will go like this, and the Dirkov cooling will go like this. So we can see that we cannot explain the majority of observations by non-superfluid neutron stars, because they are just in the middle, which is bad. And then we did the following. Let us switch on the superfluidity, and let us vary the critical temperature of the superfluidity of neutrons and protons from 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 10 kelvins. We will obtain a number of cooling curves which will fill for Murka cooling this double hatched region. So any observations which is available here within this region can be explained by standard cooling of neutron stars with superfluid cores. Then let us take the rapid cooling and also vary the critical temperatures of the superfluidity. And we will fill this hatched cooling, this hatched region. So that is why any point which is within this hatched region can be explained by the standard, by the rapid cooling of neutron stars with superfluid cores. So, which is not explained. This Candelo's source, 1055, is not explained here. But, of course, I gave this talk several times, at each time I was asked about H. Of course, the H of this source is not known. It is spin down H, and it can be uncertain.
It will, as all other sources, too, to the same extent.
Certainly, but they have no problems with other. Yes. Again, the atmospheric interpretation of this source is also out of range, and let us exclude for a while this source. We can explain it later in the same model. Now, it is certainly inconvenient to discuss cooling curves. There are too many of them. That is why we did the following. We fixed the age. For instance, let us assume the star of age of Geminga. And let us consider our basic two models. For instance, let us take the first model, Murka cooling of Geminga. If the star were non-superfluid, its internal temperature, logarithm of if internal temperature would be in this model 7.82. And let us do the following. Let us vary the critical temperatures. And for each pair of critical temperature, we would have a different internal temperature of the star. And these lines, here is logarithm of critical temperature of protons and neutrons, these lines, they are isotherms of constant internal temperatures. So varying the critical temperature, we can obtain very different range, the very different internal temperature of the star. Then let us assume atmospheric interpretation. Then we know some range of surface temperatures and internal temperatures, because we know the relationship between the surface and internal temperature. And let us plot the strip which corresponds to this range of temperatures. So if Geminga is cooling via Murka processes, so the critical temperatures of the neutron and proton superfluids should lie in this strip. But we have four other neutron stars with different ages. And let us assume that they are described by the same neutron star models. So we can plot here five different strips. And this is my last figure. Here is like this. This is the case, standard cooling and five different strips. It was amazing because they intersect in one point, in one region. Well, let us take the critical temperatures from this region, and let us assume that the star has hydrogen envelope. If we do this, we will explain the sixth point, which was excluded from the analysis. The same, it is amazing, happens if we assume rapid cooling. Again, all these strips intersect in one point, in this point. It is much more it is worse with the blackbody interpretation, because with the blackbody interpretation we can explain only three sources out of seven. They are listed here. But in all the cases of, for the cases of rapid cooling and standard cooling, there are also joint regions, regions of intersection of the corresponding strips. So, if we look at all these interpretations, we can observe that the critical temperature of the neutron superfluid in all the cases is about the same, 2 × 10⁸ kelvins. If we do not pay attention to this region. So these are the main results. And now the conclusions. The main conclusion from my point of view, that we calculated the suppression factors of different nutrient reactions, and we have now a code which implements all these calculations. This was a really tiresome job. But other conclusions is like this. Superfluidity strongly affects the cooling, thanks to Danny. Superfluidity reduces the difference between standard and rapid cooling, because this is a mess. You cannot distinguish standard cooling from slow one if the star is superfluid. Everything is mixed. Then superfluidity is required to explain observations. Then all atmospheric interpretation of observations can be explained either by standard or rapid cooling of one superfluid neutron stars with definite critical temperatures of neutron and proton superfluidities. And the final conclusion is like this. Perhaps there is some truth in this. Thank you.
Ipsilon observation shows that some sources is atmospheric was calculated with hydrogen. Now the if the composition is iron, it's closer to black body in this business. So if the some sources hydrogen, some are iron, then I think you have the things will be more complicated and. We may need both standard and non-standard. That was the conclusion I gave in my talk.
Yes, in this interpretation it may be so. Sure. This is not a question but a comment, yes?
Yeah, comment. Mm-hmm. And another thing is there is something called the plasmon process, which also Ludemann produced. The plasmon process can be that weak interaction. So that can be important when the Vulkan and Murka, you know, disappears because of the superfluidity. This electron weak interaction involving electrons only, not affected by this superfluidity. So plasmon process, which is Ludemann, that's included in our code. And also some processes in the core, a crust, may become more important than electron wavestrom. So in that corner, you may have to include those other processes too.
Yes. I think the plasma frequency is way above the temperatures you're talking about here, isn't it?
Plasma yeah. frequency is extremely high. That is why the plasmon decay into neutrino pair is absolutely unimportant in the cores.
Yes, yes.
But it is important in the crust.
Yes.
And in our code, it is included when we calculate the neutrino emissivity in the crust. But for these calculations, it is absolutely unimportant because the crust is very thin. The neutrino luminosity of the crust is very low. And that is why the neutrino luminosity from the crust may be important only at the initial cooling states. When the star is young, for instance, 10 years, maybe 50 years, when it is thermally non-relaxed. Perhaps I will, well, in the next talk I could.
So at the low temperatures, it's not important, that's the point.
Certainly not important.
What controls the temperature for the first 10 years?
Certainly. That's what I'm saying. Absolutely. Absolutely agree with you.
High temperature. Yeah.
But the plasma process from the crust, not from the core. Because in the core it is absolutely unimportant. Absolutely. Exponentially forbidden.
Very high temperature.
From the theoretical point of view, do you expect all the stars to have the same critical temperatures? Is that, like, if you didn't know, if you didn't have this evidence, would you have said beforehand that they would?
That's a very good question. Of course, yes, I think that all the stars should have the same equation of state and should have the same critical temperatures in principle. So critical temperature profiles should be absolutely the same for all neutron stars. But if in the nature they have different masses, that is why if we have variety of masses, then we have variety of different physical conditions in the stars.
So can you constrain from the closeness of those critical temperatures based on that argument, can you constrain the range of masses that you suspect?
Not now. But in principle, yes. In principle, you're absolutely right.
Is it possible to have parameterized, so another way to do the parameterization would be to parameterize the density dependence and move the scale of it down so as to always have some part of the star. I'm just wondering how much that would, I mean, the way you've done it, you get a very sharp determination of TC. And I'm wondering if you did it where you had a temperature depending on density and parameterized that function and then allowed the scale to move up and down, whether you would be able to say something in strong.
That's what we are doing now.
Excellent. Okay.
You know, in that quark stuff that Rajat Gopal talked about at the meeting, at least in the early stages of that, they had these huge gaps for their sort of superfluidity. Now, maybe Danny's the right person to respond, and then I heard various things about them. How does it end? Is there some huge distinction in that theory that will produce totally different?
Yes, you are quite right. Because if we have quark matter, there is possibility of very high critical temperatures. And in this in that case, the neutrino emissivity associated in the reactions associated with quarks will be absolutely suppressed. But there is always this miserable electron-electron collision mechanism, which is totally independent on superfluid state of quarks. And it will, well, play the leading role.
Will there be electrons?
Yes. In all the models of quark matter, there are electrons. There are not many of them, but, well, 10 to the minus 3, the concentration. 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4.
But this electron shunt will be important only if you have pure quark matter.
Yes. 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 Of course. Sure.